Welcome to Season 2 of the Unscripted Medicine Podcast, a podcast about living and learning at the UC College of Medicine.
On the show, we discuss everything from board exam prep, how to excel in your clinical clerkships, and also how to do the little things required to thrive in medical school.
Check out the show notes or our website for more information, helpful links, resources, and more.
Please connect with us via email or on Twitter. We would love to hear from you. Without further ado, we hope you enjoy today's episode.
Welcome, everybody, to the Unscripted Medicine Podcast. My name is Zach St. Clair. As always, this is episode number something. I have Kevin and Robbie here with me today, the triad of voices, which has never been experienced before since the beginning. We are here to talk about ERAS, which is a mammoth task, and we are trying to slim it down today by talking about the more practical aspects of filling it out and stylistic things related to that. So, Kevin, can you tell me a little bit about what you think we can contribute to this topic that is not already out there?
Yeah, so what we're trying to do today is offer our perspectives. Note that, you know, these are our personal experiences with ERAS, but they don't represent like facts that are universal for everybody. We'll talk about things that kept us up at night, things that we were worrying about, things that we were working on diligently throughout the entire process. But we're not going to go into things like where to apply, how to be competitive, or anything about the match. We won't talk about specialty-specific stuff that we really can't speak to. We're going to just try to keep it practical and keep it focused on the application.
And if it weren't already well known, we are applying to, collectively the three of us, to two different specialties. Me being pediatrics, Zach and Kevin for internal medicine. And although we fill out the same ERAS, there might be different approaches based upon your specialty.
And I guess it's probably worth saying, now that you mentioned that, Robbie, that we don't have a huge diversity of specialties represented among the three of us. So while our perspectives, we hope, are valuable and helpful, maybe don't take them as fact. Well, definitely don't take them as fact, but especially with us not having any surgical people here. With all that being said, let's jump into some things that maybe are helpful. So I think the timeline of ERAS is something that's really hard to keep straight. We're not going to go into specific dates here because, especially for us with COVID, everything was wonky. But maybe, Robbie, could you talk a little bit about how you approached the timeline? Let's start with the personal statement, because I think that in the course of filling out ERAS, the personal statement is the thing that you can start on the earliest, potentially. So when did you hear that was important to start your personal statement? When did you personally start it? How did you feel about your decision?
I think with the personal statement, it's not too dissimilar from that with the process you went through for applying to medical school. If you're someone who's going to start a year in advance, then I would recommend that. When I got to medical school, probably first or second year, I had a Word document where I was just creating different anecdote bullets or major themes that I thought were valuable to me. Granted, throughout my first 3 years, since my specialty changed, the keywords on that like five bullet list modify a little bit. And also, I was coming from a research year, so I had plenty of time in my research year. I actually started writing it in March. I had one of those days where I was feeling really creative and just randomly, I'm sure you guys know the feeling, it's like 9 p.m. and you're like, I have an idea. And then I wrote for about 2 hours and got a good chunk done. But a lot of it was done early enough so that I could share it with my letter writers. But at the same time, I didn't feel pressured to have that be my final one. So I think having it in order to share with your letter writers, which would be probably spring of M3, but you might ask people early, but you definitely want it to be done, I would say, a few weeks before your application is due, if anything, just so that you can understand how to put your personal statement into ERAS, because it's a little less straightforward than I think it should be.
I also started in the spring. I remember during the COVID shutdown, I specifically went on some hikes, some solo hikes on my own, with a specific explicit purpose of thinking about my personal statement on the hike, because I'm somebody who really has to think long and hard about the structure. And once I know the structure and the vision of the personal statement, it just flows from there. And so I started, probably in like April, And really, I really wish I had a draft that I could have sent to my letter writers, but I actually finished my personal statement very last, just about a week before my application was actually due. Take it from me, it's something that can just drag on forever. And so start thinking about it early.
Yeah, I think if you have anything to send to your letter writers, that's appreciated by them, because they only get to see you for a week sometimes. And so having a little bit more personal information about you helps to inform what they already know from your experiences. And just generating ideas and just jotting them down, like Robbie said, was really helpful for me. So even though I didn't have a formulated personal statement, even in like March, April, there were ideas on a page. In terms of other things, what kind of other pre-work, so to say, can you do prior to ERAS actually opening?
So I think by far the most important thing is to keep your CV updated. This is a workshop that you'll do in your learning communities, I think as a second year, because it's seriously so important. If you have a CV that is comprehensive and updated and it includes accurate and not provocative, but insightful looks into what that job or what that position was like, when it comes to actually fill out ERAS, you have it pretty much already filled out because you have an amazing CV. And so having that updated as you go along, even from M1, is awesome. And then also that's something that you can provide to your letter writers so that they can get a little bit better sense of what you're all about. And so absolutely keeping your CV updated is something that everybody can do to be prepared.
I think a lot of the logistics of ERAS you get a good idea for once you open up the portal. So I think apart from your CV, I wouldn't be too anxious about preliminarily writing items for it. You can maybe talk with someone who has applied to your specific specialty. I think there would be value in that. But I would concur that apart from updating your CV, it's best to wait until it opens up to get an idea as far as the layout. Obviously, we're going to talk about some of the components of it, but I really think that's the main thing that you want to think about before the actual date opens up.
Is there any benefit to finishing or submitting ERAS early? This was something that I had on my mind. I think the answer is no, other than maybe just you have it done. Did you guys submit at the last second like me or no?
I submitted, I think it was the Sunday before it was due, so like 3 or 4 days in advance. I did see somebody on Med Twitter who she was super on top of it. She submitted her application about a week early, was feeling super good about it, and then like 2 or 3 days later, got accepted as a first author on a publication, which was not a part of her ERAS because she submitted early. And so if you have things pending, there's probably the conservative option would be to hold off and see if those things go through. But I think having at least a couple of days ahead of the final deadline just provides peace of mind. Definitely not the day of, definitely not late, but 2 or 3 days early I think is totally reasonable.
There's at some point you just got to send your child off to school for the first day, even if you don't feel ready. And I think 3 or 4 days, just plan on it. I was actually going to do it on Monday and I saw Kevin do it, so I just hit submit because I was tired of going in and looking through and changing various grammatical things or a semicolon to a period or whatever it was. One thing I'll touch on a little bit later is with publications, there are pros and cons of that, because I had a first author publication that was submitted, which you can put on your CV, submitted articles. And I was actually rejected the Friday before I was going to hit submit. So I would have had the first author publication at the submitted status versus not on there. But I truthfully took it off. So there are pros and cons, which we can talk a little bit about all the publication categories in a sec.
The salt is palpable through this Zoom call, Robbie.
Yeah, it was my third time submitting it. So I was ready for it to be accepted. We'll just put it that way.
He's over it. He's over it.
Yeah, I don't even care anymore. It's like, whatever.
You look at peace. You look at peace.
It's just like my future and like my residency application. So yeah, no big deal.
No biggie. Yeah. No biggie. One thing that was kind of confusing for me is letters of recommendation. Wow. So do they have to be submitted prior to hitting submit on your application?
I think this is a bit of a trick question, because technically no, but I think letter writers can continue to submit even after your stuff is sent out. But if you want it to all be wrapped with a nice, pretty bow and sent out to the residency folks all at once, I think it would be a good idea just to have them all in. This is not to say that you need to stress out if one of your letter writers is straggling. I think we've all been there. But I think ideally you have at least two or three in that are sent out, with maybe one, maybe two still pending. You definitely want to have a couple letters so that you're considered complete, so that programs will actually look at your application.
That sounds reasonable. I'm getting a thumbs up from Robbie, so we'll take that, Kevin, as fact. All right, let's move into the sections of ERAS and try to get into the nitty-gritty of things that we can cover. So the first section is the seemingly most innocuous but potentially important one of the biographics. So, Robbie, you put a little thing in this outline that's not in front of us about address and geographic leverage. Can you please explain to our listeners and me what you're talking about with that?
Yeah, so I think Zach prides himself in articulating that we have an outline for every episode that he hosts.
So unscripted. So unscripted.
Of course we have notes here, but the address would be relevant for different people for different reasons. So a lot of folks who maybe come to Cincinnati for medical school from California, which our listeners, California is the second most represented state, actually. You might want to put your home address as California. It's just an easy point to demonstrate that you are very committed or that you have relationships to that geographic area. I can't underestimate the amount of importance placed upon connection to a specific area. On my last interview, it was very obvious that they recognized my interest because of a family member in the area. So that's a little thing. I wouldn't think look too much into it, but just one more added thing you could include.
Cool. What about languages? I feel like there could be some room to embellish your level of Spanish mastery. Robbie, as someone who speaks Spanish, how do you feel about this?
One thing that's helpful is they actually have ways for you to select your level of language. So for example, I identify speaking Spanish fluently. And so you can select, I don't speak at the level of a native, but I speak fluently. And that was an option. I also can understand and read Portuguese. And I did not put it at the same level as I would my English or Spanish, but I put it at a lower level. And beware, if you put a language, it might come up. In one of my interviews, they mentioned, oh yeah, we actually have a pretty high Portuguese speaking population in the area, if that would interest you. And one of those things that if I were given, you know, if I had been traveling abroad, I think I could get there, but I'm not to the point where I can take a history in Portuguese, that's for sure. So be honest, there's predetermined options for you, which is really helpful. You don't have to embellish. And particularly if you have Cincinnati, we offer language examinations, the CCLA, for those who want to be certified as a provider. And having that on your CV actually makes it a little more clear, and multiple programs noted, oh, you already have your certification. And it's a nationally recognized certification. So it translates to other institutions as well.
I listed basic Spanish and basic Italian, because the description of basic is, it's really truly like you understand some words in some sentences in some contexts or something like that. It's like very limited. And it's like, yeah, I think that is true. I think I can listen to and read Spanish and Italian much better than I can speak it myself. But I would identify as basic. And that, you know, I was a little bit worried that like, oh, maybe somebody's going to call me out on that. But, you know, just be truthful. I think really, you know, you don't want to embellish that. But, you know, if you feel like you speak some basic Spanish, then yeah, like you should put it for sure.
Yeah, there was, for example, my Portuguese says, I speak the language imperfectly and only to a limited degree in limited situations. I have difficulty in or understanding extended conversation. So that was one of the presets, and I feel it actually pretty accurately represents my experience.
I feel like that also describes my ability to speak in medical lingo as a first and second year med student.
Also just in English. So.
Yeah, that's also true. Not the right person to be hosting this podcast. Anyway, moving on. So, Kevin, talk to me about the hobbies section. Is it important? It's just like hobbies, right? Like, not that big of a deal, right?
So some piece of advice that I got from the, I think from the internet, is to actually use that space to describe a couple of specific hobbies, not just to list them all out. Because if it's just a list of random hobbies, there's really nothing you can really go on there. That's pretty generic. But I listed four specific hobbies on mine. I listed leathercraft because I actually make things with leather, like by hand. I do all the stitching, like I make wallets and stuff like that. And it's come up like, I don't know, 5 or 6 times in my interviews. Like, oh, that's so cool. You make wallets. Do you have one around? Can I see it? And of course I did have one around because, you know, med school, but and they're like, oh, wow, that's so cool. Like, great job. You know, it comes up. And then the other one I have is cycling because I love to go cycling, and that's come up at probably 6 or 7 interviews. So people actually really love to ask about those things. It seems like it's not really an important part, but I find that it comes up in conversation quite a bit.
And Kevin's on Strava if you want to follow his cycling adventures.
So is Robbie.
Zach is not.
I actually spent 8 minutes of a 25-minute interview, which is funny to say, but you actually kept track because you can see the time interviews, talking about Harry Potter. So that was a pretty good interview. I mean, if I'm spending effectively more than a quarter of my time talking about Harry Potter. So the hobby section is legit. They also, someone thought that I was a professional water skier because I just put water skiing and they just misread it. I didn't have time to clarify, but.
Just let them believe what they want to believe.
Yeah, it was harmless. I know a pro water skier. I have a few in my contacts. So yeah.
Humble brag.
What about you, Zach? What were your hobbies?
So I listed that I really like sports, but specifics about that because sports is super general. So I've been to 15 out of the 30 MLB parks, which I think is pretty unique.
Oh, that's cool.
I refereed soccer and basketball when I was younger. So I felt like when I was filling it out, I started realizing that the more specific I could be and more unique, then the more likely people would want to ask about it and talk about it. And it would make the conversations flow better during the interview. If you just put, and I'll list a couple, and this is not to say anything negative about these hobbies, but if you put like cooking or hiking or reading, just a lot of people have those hobbies, and that doesn't make them not fun, but it just is harder to talk about. I think people probably get tired of talking about the same ones. So you be strategic about which hobbies you put in there. Don't put Netflix and like binging TV shows. So I don't, do you guys agree with that?
I do. I would put your favorite book series, or if you are a culinary master, the thing that you love to bake, or your new pressure cooker that you're obsessed with.
Yeah, you got to be specific. Yeah, I think if you love reading, we'll elaborate on that more. What do you love to read and why? That they need a little bit more to go on than just reading. But that's a totally valid thing to list and to talk about. So it's really how you do it.
Yeah, just personalize it. That's the whole point. Sweet. Well, I think we've beaten that one to death. Robbie, talk to me a little bit about education and studying abroad, because I know that this was something that came up for you.
Yeah, so for your education component, you have your undergrad institution, obviously your medical school. But if you spent an extended period of time, let's say a study abroad, or you transferred undergrads, make sure to include that. I included the institution I studied abroad in Chile. Even though I was only there for a semester, it was recommended that I would. And so I threw it on there. It wasn't hard. They didn't like, there's no validation system in there. But if you were at a place for maybe just one class, it's probably not as relevant. But definitely if you studied abroad at an institution for at least a semester, it'd be worth it.
I think that's fair. I think that also closes out our biographic section. And we can move into the personal statement.
I'm just going to butt it.
Oh, go ahead.
Page where it has just like yes or no questions. Read those just really specifically, because the answer to most of them is one thing, and then the answer to one of the key ones is another thing. And so it's like there's a question in there that's like, are you able to perform the duties of a resident? And all of the other answers are like, are you a felon? Have you been fired? Do you have any restrictions on a medical license? That's like, no, 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 no. And then there's a question. It's like, can you perform the duties of a resident? It's like, yes. I saw some people online actually mess that up. And so their application says that they cannot perform the duties of a resident. So just pay specific attention there. Just worth noting.
That would be terrifying. Good point, Kev. All right, let's move into the personal statement. We talked about the timeline of when to do it, but we thought we'd touch on a couple of things about how to fill it out, how to do it, how long it should be. Let's start on that one. How long did you guys hear guidelines about your personal statement being? Because I think that the formal character limit is pretty high. I don't remember the specific number, but how long did you guys shoot for? Robbie, I'll start with you.
I think you should stick to one page, although depending upon your font and whatnot, the characters may vary. Just start with one page, get all your feedback based upon its one page, and then if you put it into ERAS and extends to another page, that's where you'll need to tweak it a little bit. But I wouldn't worry too much in your original draft. Although it may make you a little uncomfortable, I think modifying one sentence at the end or changing a few words so that it can fit nicely onto one page isn't that big of a deal. And so I wouldn't stress too much about getting it perfect the right time. Get it right in your ballpark length in a sentence, and then you can modify it once you copy and paste it into ERAS.
Yeah, the important thing on ERAS is actually the number of lines. It's not the number of characters or words. And so, you know, sometimes the end of a paragraph has a line that has only one or two words. If you need to cut down, you can cut from that paragraph and just get that to, you know, reduce a line, and you save a lot of space that way. The other thing that's worth noticing is that if you're going to write your personal statement in Word, you'll need to copy it into a plain text editor and then copy it from there into ERAS, because Word actually puts in like different characters and stuff that help with the formatting, and ERAS cannot accept those, and that actually might take up some space. So you always want to copy it into a plain text and then from plain text into ERAS. And then I would agree, I think one page is pretty much universally accepted. I don't know any specialties that recommend more than one page. Some specialties may be more or less willing to read a second page, but I think one page is pretty much gold standard now.
I remember that getting mine down to one page was the most mind-numbing experience because of what you just described, Kev, where I would copy and paste it from Word into ERAS, and then it looked like it was the right length, but because there was a line difference instead of a character difference, it just wouldn't fit. And so if you're strategic about which words you try to cut when you're editing, you might not cut as many characters, but you might cut out a line, and then you finally under that one page.
Yeah, there's also this weird thing that, like, I guess people who have Mac computers were experiencing this year, where it should fit in one page, but for some reason there was a blank second page. And I think this was unique to people who were doing their work from a Mac. And from what I heard, that blank second page really didn't matter. People didn't really care. I did go through the trouble of deleting yet another line to get that blank second page gone. But from what I've heard, it's really not a big deal if you have a blank second page.
I had a similar experience, and then I'll add one additional thing. There are certain programs that might request an additional personal statement. So in pediatrics in particular, there's one that's coming to mind that I applied to. And for that, I had two personal statements in ERAS. The one was my traditional. The second personal statement was actually a two-page personal statement, the first page being my normal personal statement. And my second page being the additional personal statement that fit nicely onto two pages. And so I signed that personal statement. I just called it X program personal statement, and I assigned it to that program. I don't know if that's the gold standard. It made sense to me and it worked great. So if you are applying to a program that asks for another personal statement, keep that in mind that you can create two different ones. You might be able to assign two, but I put it on one and then had a two-page personal statement. And it worked because we talked about it for 5 minutes in my interview, which was great.
It's also an opportunity to decide, do I really want to apply here?
We all remember that from med school. The only reason why I got an interview at one of my med schools was because everyone was afraid of their secondary.
The laziness filter. I like that. Another thing on the personal statement is, I mentioned this a little bit earlier, editing. What kind of people did you guys seek out as your editors? Were they all medical, some non-medical? Kev, I'll go to you first.
I just went to my family. I wanted somebody who would give me really thorough feedback and really have my best interests at heart. I knew from conversations with people in internal medicine what people were looking for in IM for the personal statement. So I didn't feel like I really needed a content check, but really like the grammar, the spelling, the flow, how things felt. I thought my family would do the best job on that. So that's where I went.
I would also like to point out that Kevin asked me to edit his personal statement, so I am part of his family. I just want that to be on the record.
Well, Zach is actually naming his children after Kevin and I, so I guess that means you kind of are a part of the family, right?
Yeah, you guys are family.
Allegedly. Robbie, who'd you ask?
Yeah, so I have, similar to what I did before, I had two or three people who were really trusted who are going to do an excellent job, and then a few other people just for a gestalt. So I had two advisors who read it, one of whom is a former program director at our home institution. And then I also had it read by a friend who's a professor, an English professor at a local college, and really valued the things that she had to say because she came from a non-medical background, really building the story that I was writing. And then from there, I had a plethora of people just kind of, hey, what do you think? Eventually, people are going to offer a bunch of advice. Hey, I read your personal statement. Maybe change this. I will not say who, but I had some advice from a very respected individual who I really value their opinion. However, it was the day before it was due, and I was like, I'm just not going to change it because I think that what I have is great. So you know when to draw the line, and when you feel good about it, remember, it's your personal statement. You want it to reflect you. They kind of say don't take any risks. I'm maybe a little more of the risky guy. Maybe I'm just the rebel without a cause a little bit, but you want it to reflect you. Stay within bounds. By the end of the day, go with your gut.
I feel like that sentence was the hardest thing to adhere to, is, you know, being unique without being too out there. And that's just something that you have to work on over time. I personally took the approach of a couple different advisors. So I had my editors. I had my wife look it over primarily because I trust her opinion more than anybody else's about me, obviously. I also had the writing tutor go through it with me just to help with some of the grammatical stuff, and that was really helpful. I really appreciated her doing that. And then I had one of my medical mentors and attending work through some of the content stuff with me, and that was really helpful. I think going to someone in your specialty for what to put in there, not just like what about you, but like how to structure it and like what things a program will be looking for, someone in your specialty as an advisor is key for that. So just a mix. But there's some different perspectives for you guys on who to look for. All right, I want to dive now into the section that kept me up most. And I texted Robbie and Kevin about this like 10 times. I don't know, something like that. It is the experiences section.
Can confirm.
Yeah. So, my goodness, I don't even know where to start. Robbie, do you want to talk a little bit to us about how this is different than like the AMCAS experiences section, and then like designating things as work versus volunteer and that sort of thing? Because that was a little bit weird to get used to.
Yeah, so there are three sections: work, volunteer, and research. I'll maybe tackle research because there are some nuances that I had to go through. On AMCAS, it's my understanding that's the platform you use to apply for medical school. For that in particular, I think you can select, at least circa 2015, you could select your most important activities. You don't do that in medical school. There are those three sections. So for research in particular, this gets a little challenging because the research experiences and various platforms, when you look at what's competitive for your field, will have a number of research experiences. And that's different from publications. And so publications is a separate place where I put my abstracts, my submitted papers, and such. So for research experiences, I included if they were unique experiences. So I actually worked with the same PI two different tenures. One was in transitioning into medical school, and then was a research year. So I included those as two separate experiences because my work was very different. One was more of a basic science, histologic specimen experience, when another was a large animal research. You could even break it up into projects or maybe protocols or an IRBs if you have those broken down in your research. If those who have taken multiple research experiences in undergrad and medical school, you know, you could have upwards of 7+ research experiences. And that's where you'll describe what you did. If you worked on IRBs, if you worked with animals, if you did clinical outcomes research. And it's not necessarily the lessons learned, it's what you've done. So for each of these, work, volunteer, and research, I wrote 2 to 7 sentences. Kevin probably cringed a little bit, because I wrote mine in prose and they were 7 sentences, some of them, but they were clean. I actually would have multiple paragraphs to make it easier to digest. But a lot of them, I averaged probably around 5 sentences for the description of the experience. But you can also do it in bullets as well.
I think Kevin wrote his in haikus. Isn't that right, Kev?
I did. Yeah, it was my hot take on the ERS.
That's super bold.
So I think the weird thing about the experiences for me is the volunteer category, because what it really becomes is everything that is not explicitly a research project or a paid work opportunity. So there's a lot of stuff that you will be categorizing as volunteer that really has nothing to do with volunteering. You know, obviously you have volunteer activities there, but then like hobbies or clubs or, you know, just like random stuff that you would never consider to be volunteering end up in that bucket, because those are the three buckets you've got.
I want to delve into that bucket in particular, because research and work, you're pretty much going to include everything that you did because it's just everything that you did in those subjects. But I think that for the volunteer and like extracurricular, a lot of us do a ton of things. And I had a really difficult time paring down which activities to include and which ones are okay to let fall by the wayside. And it wasn't until later in my filling out the application that someone sat me down and was like, Zach, this section is not just you listing everything you did, but you strategically listing things that you did and explaining them in a way that shows specific things about yourself that you want to convey to programs. How did you guys think about which activities to include, which ones to let go? And I guess within that is like undergrad activities, whether you include those or not. Robbie, I'll go to you.
Yeah, so there was definitely ones I left off. If I didn't want to talk about it, I didn't include it. And I felt a little weird since there was the volunteer thing. Like, I didn't put the fact that I was on the water ski team at Ohio State in undergrad. It was a substantial experience. There was actually volunteering involved, but it felt weird. However, I did include volunteering at Children's Hospital, undergrad, and those sorts of things. So to me, it was more a matter of the meaningful experiences more than just the multitude of them. We're very metric oriented, but I think having the really meaty stuff is more important. One caveat for the work experience, often the teaching experience falls into that. So I was a TA, super easy to put the under work. But I do teaching at the med school actually for an elective that I'm in that I was advised to put under work. Even though I'm technically a student, I pay to do it. But I think it's understood that teaching experiences, whether it's like Kevin or someone who has done formal teaching, that would go there, but also a volunteer teaching experience, like a tutor or those sorts of things would go under work as well.
Weird example of that as well. I did AmeriCorps volunteering. So an entire year volunteering at a food bank. And by all means, I mean, that sounds like a volunteer experience. Well, yeah, but like I was working 40 hours a week at the same place for an entire year. And I did actually get a stipend, like a paycheck to do it. It's like, is that volunteer or work? It's hard to say. I went with work.
Did any of us get questioned on our categorization?
No.
They don't.
Actually, absolutely not.
You know, I excluded quite a bit. I kept like this running list of activities that I would include on my ERAS just kind of throughout medical school. And, you know, like actually like the student interest groups, I just didn't list because if somebody were to ask me about them and be like, oh, what'd you do with that? I'd be like, yeah, it was cool. We like hosted this lunch talk and it's all we did the whole year. It's like, that's not a meaningful thing. Like, I don't want to take up space. Your application ends up being between like probably 9 and 16 pages long. You don't want to take up a big block of space with some fluff activity that doesn't matter. You want to have things that you can talk about and really show. Zach was kind of alluding to this. You want to kind of show a narrative of who you are and what you're interested in, and you want experiences that fit that.
To counter Kevin's point, just to show the variety, I wasn't an advocacy role where I actually did host a lunch talk, but there was to me it felt more meaningful because there was a little more of a narrative component about gun violence research in the pediatric population. So it was more than just a lunch talk. For you, it's up to you to determine, like, was this a meaningful experience that you would want to talk about that shows your commitment? But if it's really a limited experience, you're just putting it on there, I'd maybe question, is this something you want to talk about? Or are you just trying to have maybe an increased quantity of your experiences?
Yeah, like the one time I volunteered at MedVoc, that's not going on the application. It's not. No. But if you were like on the MedVoc board or you volunteered regularly, absolutely.
And it's all a continuum. So I think it's a very, very personal decision.
Yep.
Did you guys include like lessons learned or outcomes from your various activities, or did you just describe what you did in the various things?
I think it's more of the what you did. If there was a success or like it ended in a presentation, to tie it to your publications, that could be helpful. But I think generally speaking, it's more of a items completed and tasks done, as opposed to this was the project where I understood the value of the doctor-patient relationship. That's probably not where to put that information.
100%.
Fair enough. I think one really small thing that I just want to throw out there that's sort of related is the hours spent category. I don't know why I anguished over this so much. It's like hours per week is a little box that you can put in there. And for a lot of my activities, they were really irregular and they didn't really fit into hours per week. So my advisor just told me to throw it in the description and just put spent this many hours and just be honest about it. And I felt like that worked really well, because if you have it in some experiences and not in others, maybe it'll be look kind of weird. I don't even know if that matters, but that was just something that helped me have less anxiety. You guys don't have to comment on that. So let's just move on into the publications section. Robbie, you are welcome to begin your monologue on thoughts on this section, because you said you wanted to, and I'm a wish maker.
Sure,
granter.
Zach.
Wish granter.
Thank you. Since I have a 70-page CV, I'll just lead us here. No, the reason why I've spent time on this was because it was a little confusing. So the same section in which you put articles will actually be the same place that abstracts are listed. So it can be a little deceptive when you're seeing people's results, you know, if you're looking on maybe a place that tabulates for a specialty what you need. So articles and abstracts will be submitted as if it's the same thing. And there were times when I would clarify in an interview, I said, oh yeah, that was submitted as an abstract, we presented it, and we're working on the full manuscript or things as that. You also will be able to put in research work that has been submitted. For example, I had one that I was hoping to get submitted just to have it on for ERAS. It got submitted 3 days later. But it's a team effort, and it was still a great experience, even if it didn't get onto ERAS. You can put posters, oral presentations, and there's other things too you might not have heard of. But for example, Kevin and I actually wrote a paper that fits into kind of another, it's an other online publication category. And so there's more than just a traditional poster versus paper. And then I will say it's important to know at least the abstract version for everything you put on there. Some of my undergrad research, I was a little nervous if they were really going to pull it up, if maybe I got someone who was an expert in that field. But as long as you know the general gestalt, you should be in good shape. I actually did some research on lung transplants and had a pulmonologist interview me, which was hilarious. And I said, I was very thankful that I remembered our project very well, because we got into the nitty gritty of it a little bit. But be ready for most things. If it's that random thing deep in your CV, you're probably not going to get questioned on it, but at least know, you know, a three-liner about it.
I'm not super research-oriented, so I'm glad that we have somebody on this episode to talk about this. So thanks for that, Robbie. Moving into a very quick section, the honors and awards. You can include your undergrad stuff. That's cool, especially if it was significant. I've had a couple people ask me about an engineering project that I did and got an award for. Don't include that you honored a course or a clerkship. That's probably not the right move here. I don't think we have anything else to say. I do want to touch on the next section of programs, like applying to programs and picking programs, because there was a couple confusing things here that I didn't expect. So the first thing is tracks. So before I started picking my programs, I didn't know what these tracks were. Robbie, can you explain quickly to our listeners what to look out for, and do you have to apply to a certain track, or do you get to apply to those later? That was really weird for me when I found these.
Yeah, so you'll want to really know the programs you're applying to. I only applied to categorical three-year pediatrics programs. However, I'd considered maybe a global health track or a urban health advocacy track, which is offered at some programs. And you will occasionally apply for those through ERAS as different tracks, or occasionally you will get into those programs after match day. And so different programs will call them different things, whether it's academies, a track, electives, interest groups. They're all kind of similar things, and some are more formal than others. So keep an eye on the track. If your program has two tracks and you want to apply to both, great. You might want to you'll rank them potentially side by side, or one, two, three, however you put them on your rank list, but they will end up as two different tracks, often in ERAS, if they're the ones that you apply to as unique programs. So look at the specialty, your program specific tracks as well.
Yeah, this is an area where there's a lot of heterogeneity. Some of the tracks, it's just, yeah, like Robbie said, it's like, oh, I'm interested in med ed, and you know, we have two spots for people who will do some med ed stuff. But that doesn't really alter the structure of your residency experience other than designate you certain electives. There's some tracks that actually drastically change what your residency looks like. For instance, in a primary care track, that has way more ambulatory time than the categorical residence. You're still, you know, it's the same residency overall, and you can still do, you know, things within internal medicine if you go through the primary care track. But it really does change how your residency looks. There's some programs where you might be doing a track to get more clinical experience at a specific hospital, like a VA or one of the affiliated hospitals in the area. So it can actually make a big difference in what your residency looks like. And so as those are coming up, if some of them look interesting to you, I recommend just looking into them more. I applied to a couple of them, and some are I'm extremely excited about. So overall, mostly categorical programs for me, but a couple of those tracks were really stellar, so I went for it.
Another thing to look out for that's different than the tracks is that some hospitals and some residencies will have multiple locations in the ERAS system, and those are most of the time different programs altogether. So just be very careful about which one you're applying to. And also, sometimes there will be two programs that have very similar names but are totally different hospital systems, and you definitely don't want to mess that one up. I don't want to say any names, but if you click on the program itself within the little about page, there's a website, so you can click on that website just to make for sure that you're applying to the right place. Don't want to make that mistake. Robbie, how many programs should I apply to?
Good question. There's a lot of controversy about that right now. It's kind of funny. So who was it? Was it the program directors or some cohort of people sent out an official thing that we were hoarding interviews or that people over-applied? And then, yeah, WMC and then Thalamus, which is an interview platform, was saying, no, it's actually not different from our standpoint from any other year. But it's definitely specialty specific. It depends upon how competitive you are. There was a national recommendation for our specialty, and I actually just they recommended X number, and I applied to X plus one. So basically that exact recommendation. I think compared to most people, they're like, you only applied to that many? And I was like, I don't know. That was a national recommendation. Talk to your specialty advisor. There's some pretty good statistics on the number of interviews you need and whatnot. It's really tempting to over-apply, but as best you can, don't. And if you need to cancel an interview, do it. I've canceled an interview. I think maybe all of us have canceled an interview.
Yeah.
So the charting outcomes has a really great graph for each specialty, and it shows your chances of matching based on the number of contiguous rank list items within that specialty. And so for internal medicine, for instance, if you have about, I think it's either 9 or 10 programs on your list, it's like 99.99% chance of matching. So it's like, okay, well, that sounds good. I want that. And so, you know, I knew I was shooting for about 10 interviews. And then you can make an assumption. You can say, well, you know, you're much more likely to get an interview for residency than you are to get into medical school initially. And so I figured, you know, but probably between 1/3 and 1/2 of the programs that I apply to, I'll get an interview at. And so you just do simple math. It's like, okay, I'll apply to between 20 and 25 programs. And that's what I did.
I think this is a deep, deep hole that we could spend a lot of time on, but I want to throw out one name. Brian Carmody is his name, the Sheriff of Sodium. I'll put a link to his blog in the chat. I've really enjoyed reading his thoughts. He's a pediatric nephrologist, and I really enjoyed reading his thoughts on the ERAS system and how to apply smart and that sort of thing. So he's a little bit, maybe a fiery voice in this field, but I think he has some really good thoughts. So we'll probably leave it there for now. I want to move on to letters of recommendation. We talked about a couple of these things, whether they had to be submitted prior to the send out date. How many different types of letters do we need? Can they all be from the same specialty? Should I get one from my research PI? What do you think, Robbie?
I think that I had 6 total, which feels a little provocative, but I have one for my research PI, which actually was the one that was quoted the most, and that was frowned upon. People say, really, you don't need to include one from your PI, but had a longitudinal relationship with Dr. B. He is amazing, and he had very kind things. Hopefully, we're not over-embellished, and they're not going to get the product they're expecting, but I had 6, and I assigned different ones to different programs based upon a little bit of their profile, which my advisor helped me select. I had a really great relationship with a mentor that was longitudinal. Even though he wasn't in the field, I wanted a letter from him, and so I included that on some. Some programs will require a program director, sorry, not a program director, a chair letter. And so I had to schedule a meeting with the chair of pediatrics and included that as a letter. Occasionally they'll accept a surrogate from a clerkship director or things like that. But I think it's pretty standard to try to have at least one fourth year letter of a clinical experience, at least one letter from a third year experience within your specialty if you could. And then from there, your adjuncts are whatever you need that you think would supplement your application. For those applying to some of the less traditional tracks, you might have an intern year that will require a medicine letter, even though you're applying to radiation oncology. So it's specialty specific. Your advisors will really be able to help you on it. It's better to have more letters than not.
As a third year student, if you can get a couple letters at some point from fields that you're thinking about, it's going to go a long way. It's nice to just have letters there, because then you know, well, worst case scenario, if my letter writers as a fourth year student are just dragging their feet, I've got one or two in my pocket that I can attach to my application, and I'll have those there. For me, I was in internal medicine. I knew I wanted to do internal medicine like since the beginning of time. And so all of my letters were from internists. I had a chair letter. But I did have 2 letters from my fourth year AIs, and then I included 1 from my third year clerkship. So yeah, it's incredibly specialty specific, and so definitely wanted to defer to specialty advisors for that.
Kevin, our letter writers are very busy people. When is it okay? When should I contact them if they have not given my letter of recommendation to the almighty ERAS system?
I guess that's like dependent on your own level of neuroticism.
Is that a word?
That has to be a word. We're making it a word. Webster's Merriam call.
I just told my letter writers that they were due like 2 weeks before they actually were due, because I figured some people would probably drag their feet a little bit. And that ended up being a good call. I had one letter writer who uploaded, I think, the night before ERAS went out, or like maybe 2 nights before ERAS went out, but like really right up to the deadline, which that made me really nervous. At that point, I was kind of sending him emails, you know, kind of 2 weeks ahead of that. And then I was sending text messages and kind of on a daily basis towards the end. Yeah, it's uncomfortable because, you know, these physicians are incredibly busy. And you want them to write a really good letter, so you don't want to like bother them, right? But at the same time, trying to get that letter in on time is important. So I would say for your first poke, maybe like a month out, and say, hey, just wanted to check in with you. I'm excited because the application's going to come out in a month. Let me know if you need anything to complete the letter. And then maybe like 2 weeks later, it's like, hey, you know, 2 weeks until the application, and then maybe a week. And then maybe switch to a daily schedule towards the end. I don't know. What did you guys do?
This might be mind-blowing, but I actually always have my due date for these, for all my letter writers, a month or 3 weeks before the due date, because I know someone's going to violate it. Even though 2 of my writers were APDs and they totally know when they're due, I would just call it my deadline for these is this date. You know, with a really kind email, smiley face, emoji, heart, you're the best. And no one ever really gave me any grief. I would agree with Kevin that the persistence is key. You know, you're being an advocate for your own learning here. I wouldn't feel too bad about it. And then eventually there was maybe 1 or 2 that were within the last 2 weeks. And then I would give them text reminders. So just give them an earlier date to shoot for and say it's just your self-imposed deadline because you're going to submit early. And I think that they'll probably rise to the occasion, but there might be those who turn in the day of, and you just got to be persistent and don't be ashamed to stay on them because they appreciate it. And just a life thing, whenever you're sending something out, always give a deadline, even if it's maybe a little early or a little late, because when people are busy, it's helpful just to have something to work towards. So just giving them a goal will actually set them up for success.
Yeah, the people writing your letters are just like you. They're humans. And sometimes if there's not a firm deadline, you just don't get it done and you prioritize the things that do have deadlines. It's just natural life.
Exactly.
Circumstances. Alrighty. I think we've covered a lot of good stuff. Let's dive into some miscellaneous closing tips here. A couple things I wanted to touch on. Personal pet peeves, not pet peeves, personal pet interests. Uploading your transcript and USMLE scores was not super intuitive, but the ERAS people, AAMC, released a really good guide that's very step-by-step on how to do this. So make sure you just do that early because it can take a little bit of time to get your transcripts and USMLE scores to the actual system. So just don't start that late.
Hopefully I did that. I don't remember doing it, but I'm sure I did.
Well, we'll find out in March.
No, just kidding.
Another thing, this is personal. I don't know if you guys did this, but I printed out my entire application and had my wife read through it with me because ERAS doesn't have spell check. And so it can all look good when you're just looking at it in the system. But once you printed it out, it's like, oh, okay, that's not a word. That's some weird grammar. So that was helpful for me. Maybe that's my neuroticism, as we said earlier.
Yeah, my tip there is actually to use the speech to text function on your computer, because your computer is going to read it exactly as it is written. And so you just have the robot read out the entire thing. I do that for all of my important papers and things, and it works wonders. So I think it's like an accessibility function on most computers.
Maybe it's because I'm the guy who always has errors and publications that I submit, and I'm like, did I really do that? But I just kind of send it. Like, I read it through a few times and don't freak out about it. So I actually didn't print it. I had someone prepare to start to look through it, and I was like, you know what, don't waste your time. So if you've read through it 100 times, there's probably going to be errors in there. Hopefully you catch the best and hope for the best. I don't know if your advisor would love that advice, but sometimes you're just going to labor over this so many times. You're going to log in 100 times. Granted, keep in mind, I'm a people pleaser and Mr. I have to have it perfect. So going from that perspective, but sometimes you just got to hit submit.
Yeah, this is a surprising statement personality-wise, Robbie. Not going to lie.
I'm honestly shocked.
Kevin's mouth is on the floor. But we can move on. Robbie, what other tips do you have for our listeners as we close here?
Yeah, so once ERAS opens, just familiarize yourself with it. I actually had a week of nights that was pretty light in between admissions. After, checking labs, I would just write a description and got a lot of those things into ERAS. I will say, make sure to hit save. I've completed a few of my activities and realized it didn't save because I would see a new patient and then would forget that it was up. So hit save so you don't lose all of your work. But yeah, just start early and set those self-imposed deadlines so that you're not scrambling the day before. Because as a fourth year, you're busy. Granted, for me, I was not on clinical rotations the month it was due. But if you are, just have your deadline to be done early. That way you can print the PDF, actual print it, or just view it in PDF, review it, share it. But if you start early, you can't go wrong. And then maybe my last thing that I'll say is that time thing that Zach mentioned earlier where you put your commitments, just put an estimation. Ironically, I had someone talk to me about it, like, oh, you still do this for 5 hours a week. And I was like, did I really put that? And I was like, oh, actually, I do it for 5 hours a week. But if you don't need to overestimate, even though it feels like not medical student-y to put your commitment as 1 hour a week for something, but that actually is pretty substantial if you're doing it longitudinally. So don't be afraid or insecure about everything you put, that it has to be the best in the world. It's just one component of what's most likely an outstanding application. So when you've got it onto paper, you've started early, hit submit, fight the imposter syndrome, fight all the insecurities. You've done so much good stuff to date. Just send it off and let it fly.
Thanks, Dad. I mean, Robbie. back to what Zach was saying, start early. So M4, everybody knows that M4 is like the best year, fourth year best year, but the beginning part of M4 is actually insanely busy. you have AIs, step two, and residency applications all at once. And so start early. I did not do this, and I was just completely suffering for that fact. I had a classmate who had it up in June, and I was kind of like making fun of him, like, oh, wow, haha, getting an early start. And then like come to find out, like, he was an absolute genius, and I should have followed his footsteps.
Kevin, you don't have to talk about me like that.
I think he was talking about me, actually.
Yeah, right? Yeah. Because, yeah, this stuff just like flies by. We had an extra several weeks to fill this out, and if we hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been done. Like, I truly wouldn't have been able to do it. So plan early and start early.
I kept telling myself that I would start my personal statement the next week, and then it was October and I was crying. I you do not want to be doing this application on a super busy rotation like an AI. It's almost like a part-time job when you're really in the thick of things, and it was very stressful for me trying to complete stuff on a busy rotation. So as much as you can avoid that, I would. Any other closing thoughts, guys? Any recommendations you have?
If you're listening to this as an M1 or an M2, just remember that you're going to do a great job going forward, but do something you really love. I found that the things on my application that really were fun to talk about were the stuff that I poured my heart and soul into that I just didn't feel obligated to do. In a lot of the interviews that you're doing for residency, they'll often ask you, what do you want to talk about? What's something you were proud of all the things on your application here? What do you want me to know about you? And I found the open-endedness really enabled me to actually drive the ship of the interview itself, which is a topic for another episode. But it stems from the activities you've done, which you included on ERAS. So as you're looking ahead, don't just do what you feel you're obligated to do. Do what you're passionate about, what's unique, something that you would love to talk about when you're applying to residency. Because you don't want to put a false pretense forward as someone who's all in for something that you're really not all in for.
I think that's actually a beautiful thought, Robbie, because I remember talking with you as an M1 saying, like, Robbie, I have no idea what extracurriculars I want to do. I feel like everyone around me is involved in everything. And then I was sitting down filling out my application for residency, and I looked at the activities that I had gotten involved in, and I was like, wow, I'm really proud of all the things that I did in medical school, and I'm really glad that I did those in the amount that I did them and didn't try to stretch myself too thin. And now during my interviews, I can genuinely speak about these things because I did them because I care about them.
Random funny story. I was on one of my interviews, and we were with the program director, and they just wanted to get to know us. And one of the things they asked was people you're grateful for. And, you know, everyone puts like their significant other or their mom. And I said, you guys, because we were texting all the time about all of our interview ups and downs. And I was like, oh, there's these two friends of mine that are just such good friends. And we just complain and we just are in it together. So there you go, guys.
Aww.
We don't complain. We brainstorm solutions. That's the spin.
Also, I might have put my significant other, but I don't know who she is yet. So
if you're out there,
you're thankful for her prophylactically.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, to our listeners to this episode, we hope that this was a helpful discussion on ERAS, not a bunch of facts on how to be a good applicant or even facts on how to fill out the application most optimally, but just some perspectives from a couple of guys who recently filled out ERAS and are in the thick of things with interviews. We hope that's what you were looking for, and we hope that we provided that. And we hope that you come back. We're going to have some more episodes on M4 stuff if they're not already uploaded. And we appreciate you guys all listening. Thanks to Kevin and Robbie for joining me. And we'll talk to you guys on the next one. See ya.
See ya. Thank you.
Best of luck. So do you want on clap or on one?
On clap.
Okay.
All right. Are you ready? 3, 2, 1, clap.